you've got to balance the idea that the doctors that first work with you are going to understand that they have technology that isn't complete in a way, right? That this isn't the final generation. But you need to have developed in such a way that they can, there is a real path to that final generation.
Welcome to MedCider, where you can learn from the brightest founders and CEOs in medical devices and health technology. Join tens of thousands of ambitious doers as we unpack the insights, tactics, and secrets behind the most successful life science startups in the world. Now, here's your host, Scott Nelson.
Hey everyone, it's Scott. In this episode of MedCider, I sat down with Dan Rose, a repeat guest here on the program and a leader with over 25 years of experience in the medical device space. Dan has worked in both multinational corporations and startup ventures throughout his storied career. Most recently, he led LymphFlow's exit to Inari Medical as the company's CEO, and previously held pivotal positions at DirectFlow Medical, Sequana Medical, Medtronic, and others. Here are a few of the key things that we discussed in this conversation. First, vet your potential investors carefully and consider how their involvement will impact your business operations, especially if there are multiple parties involved. Limit their influence on decision-making to maintain flexibility and control over your company's direction. Second, in the early development phases, design for the average user to maximize adoption rates. Always iterate towards simplicity and be prepared to pivot accordingly. Don't focus solely on cutting-edge features or only cater to the experts. And don't hold on to complex elements or features simply because they were part of the original plan. Third, understanding the reimbursement landscape and how your technology fits into that is crucial to progress your conversations with VCs. Research potential investors to ensure that they have the capacity to invest and that their interests match your company's focus. Pursue those who can make substantial contributions, streamlining your fundraising process. All right, before we jump into this episode, I wanted to let you know that the latest edition of MedCider Mentors is now live. We just published Volume 5, which summarizes the key learnings from the most popular MedCider interviews over the last several months with incredible entrepreneurs like Gabriel Jones, CEO of Proprio, Kirsten Carroll, CEO of Can Do Health, Dr. David Alpert, founder of AliveCor, Greg Bullington, CEO of Magnolia Medical, and other leaders of some of the hottest startups in our space. Look, it's tough to listen or read every interview that comes out, even the best ones, but there are so many valuable lessons you can pick up from the founders and CEOs that join our program. So that's why we decided to create MedCider Mentors. It's the easiest way for you to learn from the world's best medical device and health technology entrepreneurs in one central place. To check out the latest volume, head over to MedCiderRadio.com/mentors. Premium members get free access to all past and future volumes. If you're not a premium member yet, you should definitely consider signing up. In addition to every volume of MedCider Mentors, you'll get full access to the entire library of interviews dating back to 2010. You'll also be able to see all of our playbooks, which are handpicked collections of the most insightful interviews with the brightest founders and CEOs that join our program. Whether you're looking to master capital fundraising, navigate early stage development, tackle regulatory challenges, understand reimbursement, or position your venture for a meaningful exit, MedCider playbooks have you covered. And last, considering that fundraising can be one of the most daunting tasks for any startup, we created a meticulous database of investors right at your fingertips. Explore a wealth of VC funds, private equity firms, angel groups, and more, all eager to invest in medical device and health technology startups. Access to this database is a premium member exclusive, so don't miss out. Learn more about MedCider Mentors and our premium memberships by visiting MedCiderRadio.com/mentors. All right, without further ado, let's jump into the interview. All right, Dan, welcome back for a round two to MedCider Radio. Really appreciate you you carving out a little bit of time in your schedule to do another MedCider interview, but really looking forward to this discussion.
Thanks, Scott. I really appreciate the invitation. And last conversation was great. So looking forward to giving the update.
Yeah. And, you know, I think, gosh, we reported that maybe back in 2020, which I think you were probably in the throes of clinical work at LymphFlow. And I can't imagine the hurdles that you had to cross throughout kind of the pandemic, you know, running clinical studies. But kudos, huge kudos to your team on what you're able to accomplish at LymphFlow. So you just... Rare that you see, you know, these types of success stories in med tech. So thrilled to have you back on. So with that said, let's spend maybe 5 or 10 minutes kind of, you know, covering the basics. So I recorded your bio at the outset of the interview. If you're listening to this and not familiar with Dan, you can certainly go back, you know, gosh, 4 or 5 years now and listen to the first time he was on, which was sort of the early stages of LymphFlow at that point in time. But If you can, like maybe just give us an elevator kind of style overview of your background from your perspective, kind of leading up to your role at LimFlow and now, you know, recording this in early 24.
No, absolutely. I mean, my background is a little different than many, primarily from just a geographical point of view. So I'm born and raised American from Virginia. But I've been in Europe now since 1999, so almost 25 years now, which is crazy to think about. Certainly wasn't the plan. Almost all of that in med tech in one way or the other. So I came over after business school, did some early stage venture capital work, ended up co-founding a device company out of that in the diabetes space, which we kind of got set up quickly and very quickly put into a short clinical trial that showed it wasn't working well enough. And so we shut it down. And I, at that time, moved from London to Switzerland with my partner, who's now my wife, and who was born and raised in Switzerland, and went to work for Medtronic, so at the European headquarters. And I, in fact, live still in Switzerland, and I live like 3 miles from the Medtronic Europe headquarters. So even though I moved far, I ended up staying in the same place for a long time. I worked initially at Medtronic in cardiac surgery, which was still a very vibrant place at that time, a lot of off-pump bypass surgery. I was doing surgical AF work, a lot of anastomotic technologies that Medtronic was looking at. I launched a bunch of products, traveled all over seeing procedures and really getting a great experience and grounding in med tech from a marketing point of view. Then went up to the Nordic region and ran Medtronic Vascular for 3 years out of Stockholm. So had 3 different business units, 5 different countries, including Iceland, and had a tremendous time leading the teams up there and getting some kind of carrying the bag experience, or almost carrying the bag experience, one step from it. And that was great, and came back then to Medtronic Europe and was the head of marketing for the coronary business, which was back in the heyday of the drug-eluting stent days, $400 million in revenue just in Europe, and you know, really aggressive, competitive markets. So that was fun. Left then to join Sequana Medical in the implantable pump space in Zurich, chief commercial officer, but also ended up running clinical, which was my first kind of job, a little or responsibility outside of more the commercial side of things. Then head of commercial for direct flow medical and structural heart space. That was right. We were kind of third to market in the structural, in the TAVR space. You know, again, the early days of TAVR, extreme risk patients, very exciting, fast moving, aggressive market. Generated about $30 million in the first 24 months or so. So a pretty great launch, just primarily in Germany. And then left there to become the CEO of LimFlow in August of 2016, and spent the past 7 years doing that. So, and that culminated in November in the exit with Inari. Mm-hmm. And since then, I've been acting in an advisory role to Inari as part of the transition.
So. Yeah, very impressive background. And for those listening, you may have heard of LimFlow even for the first time, right? After Inari acquired the company. But I always like to kind of emphasize the fact that, you know, most people, if they haven't heard of LimFlow, they're like, oh, wow, you know, a fast moving startup, overnight success story, you know, and it's like, no, I've been working on this for, you know, the better part of 7+ years, you know what I mean? So these roads in med tech are long and windy and full of challenges. So before we kind of go back in time and learn a little bit more about, you know, kind of what you went through building the company and even your prior experiences, for those that aren't familiar with LimFlow's technology, maybe give us a really high level overview, almost as if I'm a freshman in high school trying to, you know, learn a little bit more about the technology.
Sure. So, I mean, one of the biggest problems in certainly cardiovascular healthcare today, and it is related to the obesity epidemic and the diabetic epidemic and kind of cardiovascular disease, atherosclerosis, the building up of plaque and calcium in the arteries, which blocks blood flow. All of these things leads to a high rate of amputation these days. We have a lot of major lower limb amputation, which means basically taking off your leg below the knee or just above the knee. And this is associated with a huge amount of morbidity and mortality, early death, certainly mortality rates at 5 years that are on par with or worse than the worst, most aggressive cancers you can think of. So, and we're doing about 120,000 major lower limb amputations in the US every year. And the problem is getting blood flow to the foot. And limb flow does something different than just trying to open up the blockages in the arteries, and that's to go around them and essentially use the veins, which we know run alongside the arteries, but in the opposite direction in terms of blood flow throughout the body, right? Arteries take blood from the heart to the tissue, and veins take blood from the tissue, deoxygenated blood back to the heart. So we're saying, well, maybe we can, these pathways are next to each other. Atherosclerosis does not exist in veins, so the veins are often healthy when the arteries are not. So can we use the artery to deliver oxygenated blood? And that's what limb flow is in its essence. We use some wires and catheters to connect the arteries and veins, and then we place a covered stent across the artery into the vein to make sure the blood goes in the wrong direction, really, because veins are supposed to run back to the heart. And then use a tool called a valvulotome to take out the valves and veins, which keeps blood from running in the wrong direction. And this restores blood flow, allows the foot to heal, and allows amputation to be avoided. And we had a lot of technology development to get there, ultimately culminating in a large pivotal trial and a publication in the New England Journal of Medicine, because it's such a big problem in global healthcare, but particularly in the U.S., and there's such an opportunity to improve care based off of the limited effectiveness of many of the tools we have today.
Yeah, that's a great overview. And I think for those listening that aren't familiar with kind of the cardiovascular space, and really more specific, the peripheral vascular space, this is a huge need, as you pointed out, right? I think it's not well known, the mortality rates around or post amputation, right? And so it's definitely a very significant issue in healthcare. There's no doubt.
One of the most, I had spent some time in peripheral when I was at Medtronic, but one of the most interesting and surprising things to me, but less and less surprising as we went, is how often people, when I explained what I did, were like, "Oh yeah, my uncle." Hmm. Oh yeah, one of my best friends told me, "Oh yeah, that was my father died mm-hmm. of a diabetic foot ulcer infection." And so it's everywhere, mm-hmm. And particularly in marginalized communities, which are over affected by diabetes and obesity, et cetera, and access to care, where there's just a massive, massive epidemic, and we need to do something about it. And we hope LimFlow can really play a role in that.
Yep, no doubt. And if you're new to the technology, LimFlow, even though it's now under the Inari family, the site's still up. LimFlow.com, LimFlow.com, LimFlow.com. We'll link to it in the full write-up on MedCyter, but definitely encourage you to check out the technology in more detail if you're interested. So with that said, we'll go kind of rewind the clock and go, step inside the old MedCyter time machine here in a bit. But I don't expect you to kind of unveil great details around with respect to kind of where Inari is headed per se. But when you look at over the next 12 months, kind of what does that look like in terms of Inari's kind of incorporation of LimFlow into the company?
Well, I mean, what we really feel is that LimFlow is really had a market development strategy, right? Mm-hmm. Start small, embed the technology in a limited number of sites, train them up, and expand. And Inari did something similar when they launched their technology, 5 or 6 years ago, in the what they call the VTE space, either for pulmonary embolism or deep vein thrombosis. And so what they did back then is very much what needs to be done with LimFlow now. Mm-hmm. And so, and they have a tremendous, therapy development mindset. They have a tremendous commercial organization and infrastructure. And so what we're going to see is, and what they have explained, I think, publicly, is that LimFlow will be a kind of a dedicated business unit and be run, to really focus on and develop that technology, which is in a slightly different marketplace than really and customer base than they're in today. But over time offers a huge number of synergies. So, yeah. And certainly from our perspective of culture and market development mindset and infrastructure, it was a beautiful landing place for the LimFlow technology. Yeah.
That's a really good point. I actually haven't thought about that in great detail because, you know, some folks would be like, wait, I thought Inari was a venous company, right? And now they're acquiring a technology for CLI or chronic limb ischemia. That's a really good point. Like the market development kind of work that they did early on definitely applies right here. There's no doubt. They're actually quite good at that. So
Absolutely. And we felt that from the very beginning and they felt it too. It was constantly like, oh, we have this shared vision and mindset, even if theirs was, you know, a few years before.
Yeah, no doubt. Cool. So with that said, let's spend the next maybe 20 or 30 minutes learning a little bit more about some key functional areas, right, that you were able to kind of, you know, tackle and knock off building Inari. And feel free to kind of layer in previous experiences that you mentioned, you know, whether it's at Medtronic, at Direct Flow, et cetera. But the first one is that stands out to me, kind of thinking about most recently, right, your experience at LimFlow is Inari, I think, invested. I don't recall exactly at what stage of LimFlow, only to eventually acquire the company. And I think a lot of med tech entrepreneurs struggle with this idea of like, how involved should they get with a strategic, either early on from a kind of in terms of participating in a fundraise, and then maybe as they, you know, are beginning to get interest from various strategics, you know, towards maybe the, you know, certain inflection points along the road, how do they best collaborate, partner, work that process, so to speak? So maybe if you can touch on, maybe touch on both, or maybe touch on, you know, kind of the investment side specifically, and how that ended up working out for LimFlow and Inari.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is an interesting question, and I have to say, like, I'm of two minds on it. I was at Direct Flow Medical, which had, I think, three or four strategics at one point invested, and that creates a different scenario, I think, you know, that's quite complicated. And you know, you never know, like, are they watching each other to make a move? Are they, you know, how much is knowing how, seeing how the sausage is made, helping or hurting? So, I mean, that experience kind of made me wary, I would say, of having strategics involved, to be honest. I mean, sometimes board meetings could feel maybe more like roadshows than efficient board meetings. So, I'm a great believer that a board meeting should be a working meeting, right? And so at LimFlow, I felt similarly. I was like, we had different strategic interests. I certainly, was cultivating strategic interest in acquisition constantly, right? Because I think it takes that over years and years, you develop relationships with, it's the same people. Usually there's some turnover, but oftentimes there's a lot of consistency in who you're talking to. And it takes a long time for everyone at these businesses to understand what you're doing, right? Mm-hmm. You think it's not just one conversation and they're magically transmitting that message back to everybody inside, whatever organization you're talking to, as well as you are, right? So it's like every opportunity, every time you can tell the story, show that you're delivering. But I wasn't excited about having investment, and I certainly was very wary of, you know, having rights, right? Mm-hmm. And that's something you don't want to have, because it can set off, stop future opportunities. But we had some, normal discussions with Inari over the years. And ultimately, as we were putting together our Series D, they had expressed some interest. And we decided to, because of the good relationship between us and shared culture, and we decided to kind of allow them to join in, but without any rights. And I think that was quite important for us to keep our options open. And they had an observer role, and it was wonderful. They played a great observer role, helped us with certain thoughts about commercialization, right? And advice that wasn't attached to anything, just kind of like, hey, we're all in it together. And it was very fruitful collaboration, but very organic in how it developed, I would say.
Yeah. Your comment around, I want to touch on a couple things that you mentioned, but your comment around working board meetings, I mean, spoken like a true entrepreneur, right? It's like the death of me when a board meeting gets turned into like some sort of like pitch and roadshow, as you pointed. I mean, gosh, if you know, for all the med tech, founders, CEOs that are listening, you know, try to aim for working board meetings that are actually helpful to pushing the business forward. But Dan, your comment around the number of conversations and sort of the relationship building that needs to go on, not just with strategics, but even with investors that may say no, that may not do anything. Man, that really resonates with me. Specifically, maybe it's just kind of where we're at with Fastwave, but that's so crucial. And I'm sure you run into probably even more entrepreneurs that are hesitant to have any sort of conversations, right? And they want to almost keep what they're building sort of to themselves or in stealth. And I just in most cases, that's not helpful, right? You need to be having a lot of discussions, a lot of conversations. So I think that's really, I'm really glad you mentioned that.
LimFlow is, again, we were doing something nobody else was doing, mm-hmm. right? So, and it was hard. So nobody else was eager to go and try and do it after us until we prove it. I'm sure, mm-hmm. People are thinking today, maybe they should have been working on this, but it's a very long road, implantables, PMA process, et cetera. But look, the guy who tells you no in the Series C is maybe putting money into your Series D. Mm-hmm. Right. And he may be putting money into your Series D because during the Series C, you know, he grew to know you, trust you. You told him what you were going to go and do. And then you went and did it. And now in the Series D, he's like, oh, I've known the guy for years. He mm-hmm. does what he says he's going to do. And I mean, that happens and that's real. So I think that it is a small world mm-hmm. and people watch what you do. Consistency of communication is key. Obviously if you have trade secrets or some kind of fast follower, there is some, level of secrecy, but I've also found that most everybody knows what everybody else is doing, it's a very small world and, there are few things that are truly, submersed.
Yes. Yeah. 100%. Yeah. We're recording this on video for everyone listening, but I'm like totally nodding my head to pretty much everything Dan is saying, because it's so true. I mean, and it can be frustrating when you have, conversations with whether it's a strategic or a potential capital partner, and you feel like maybe it's even the second or third conversation, they're still not really leaning in. It's likely going to yield some sort of fruit, right? Maybe they never invest, right? But they may be in the same sort of network as someone else that may eventually, invest in your company or even potentially acquire. And so those conversations aren't lost. Those discussions aren't lost. And And Dan, your point about even some of those early discussions and sort of signaling what you're attempting to do and the time frame that you're going to try to execute against. And then when you do that and you actually are, you can hit those timelines, that's really, really huge, right? Because half the battle is actually just demonstrating that your team can do it.
Well, yeah. And I would more emphasize can do it, right? I mean, everybody's late and everybody spends more money than they said they would. I mean, it's very rare not to. Mm-hmm. And the VCs are used to that. I'm not saying you should be proud of it, but don't be afraid to go back and talk to them about it. As long as you did what you said you're going to do, you mm-hmm. delivered, right? And you did it in an intelligent way, in a thoughtful way, in a strategic way. We all know that there are unexpected challenges out there. I mean, it's just a constant, right? I mean, something is going to get in your way that you didn't think about. Mm-hmm. And it's always going to slow you up. And how you work through it is the testament that you can solve the next set of problems that are always going to come.
Hmm. Yeah, that's good stuff. Let's shift gears a little bit and talk about development, because it certainly applies to how we spend money and the timelines that we're trying to operate under. But this is one of the most difficult things, I think, for any med tech, founder, because typically you have a pretty lean amount of capital or pretty reduced amount of capital to work with in the early stages. And you're just trying to get to the next iteration of that particular device, right? Whether it's going from kind of concept to alpha or alpha to beta. And when you think about your experiences, whether it's at DirectFlow or even LimFlow, I imagine the device that you were in your PMA pivotals looked a lot different, right? Than the devices that you probably used for your first in human studies, right? So when you think about just that topic in general, how do you coach up other founders and CEOs to kind of move quickly, make hard decisions with a really limited amount of resources?
I think this is one of the harder things to do, right? And we made our own, as you say, the system we started with is not the system we finished with. Mm-hmm. And one of the things we did is we actually innovated out a huge amount of the complexity of what we're doing. We're using ultrasound to guide the catheters and the connections between artery and vein, and we ultimately got rid of that, and which meant we had no software, no hardware, and we dropped crossing times by an hour. But it was a hard decision to do because we had a ton of IP around ultrasound, and I had to turn around and say, "Well, no, we don't need that." Right? Company was kind of founded around it, but we don't need that. So these are active discussions. They're hard discussions. I think one thing is that you've got to balance the idea that the doctors that first work with you are going to understand that they have technology that isn't complete in a way, right? That this isn't the final generation. But you need to have developed in such a way that there is a real path to that final generation, right? And you need to be aiming at the average user, right? Through iterations, you have to be getting towards that average guy who can do it with a basic set of skills, right in the middle of the curve. Ultimately, that drives necessary, and you can't wait for a strategic to do it, right? An acquirer to do it. It has to be done before then. And maybe it can be done when you have more money, but it has to be done. And ultimately, I found that conversation of taking complexity out and aiming for the average guy, you get creative around procedure, you get creative around technology, you get creative around development because you're forcing yourself to say no. Just getting a great outcome with a super complex way of doing it is not good enough, right? And again, there's going to be that tension between money, time, and perfection, right? But you won't get it perfectly right, but I think you have to keep the end in mind and keep the current user, which is again usually someone more advanced, a first in man guy who's going to say, yeah, I can get it done with whatever, and the end user, right? Which is very definitely not that person you're working with today.
Such good comments. I was having a conversation, gosh, it was a couple weeks ago with one of our advisors, and this is a very, very skilled operator, probably one of the most, world renowned folks, especially when it comes to CTOs. And he made that very same comment, like, you can't be designing your device for me, right? You have to be designing it for the middle of the road user, as you pointed out. And I think that's such good advice for, for those of, those of you that are listening that are at the stage, right, where you're trying to make some of these hard decisions, right? If there's a bunch of, what was the phrase you just used, Dan? Even if your solution solves the need, but it does it in a very complex, kind of sophisticated way, that's gonna, lead to a lot of friction in adoption. That's gonna be a tough road to haul.
And the strategics will understand that. I mean, like, I mean, they're very astute, right? In this, and their advisors are very astute in this. So you can't fool anybody, at the end.
Yeah, no doubt. One other thing that you mentioned, the decision around removing, I think you said ultrasound, kind of from the early kind of versions of the of LimFlow. I mean, I don't, it, probably in retrospect, it's easy to kind of say, yeah, we killed that. It was hard, but I can't imagine, like, at the time, especially if, like, you had a lot, like, to your point, you had a lot of IP around that. That was probably a very, very challenging discussion and ultimate decision. And I think it's just important to kind of bring up, like, there's going to be a lot of those types of probably decisions along the road. I'm sure there was during your kind of 7+ year journey at LimFlow. And man, that's it's part of the game, right? It's making tough decisions because they're never easy.
Yeah, I mean, if you've got a great team, and you have a culture where you can stress test ideas, with each other, and the best idea wins, hopefully you've been iterative enough in the discussions where by the time you're ready to do it, like, you're all so convinced that that's what you need to do that, and you've had those pre-conversations with the board. I think that's another thing about boards is there should be zero surprises in a board meeting. Zero. From my perspective, right? Everything should be, board members should be aware of what's going on if there's something very material, before they get in. So the conversation can be fruitful and everybody's had time to kind of marinate a little bit before they get in and be reactive, right? And so I think there's a fair amount of CEO work there to make sure that those conversations can happen in the right way.
Yeah. I think it was, I recently had Harley Sorkin on the program. He's the CEO of Intershunt, and he used this analogy of the best CEOs often sit kind of at that, kind of in the middle of an hourglass, right? Where you've got to sort of disseminate information that's kind of coming upstream from your team. And then how you effectively communicate to your investors, your board members, et cetera, is really, really crucial. And can't emphasize that enough, right? If you're expecting to have a working board meeting, a lot of communication is needed, right? Leading up to that, for sure. So let's talk a little bit, kind of thinking about ClinReg, right? And you guys you and your team were able to accomplish some pretty significant or hit some pretty significant milestones through that process. Ultimately, conducting a full on PMA trial. Not to mention that I think a lot of your early, some of your early clinical work was right around COVID, which further exacerbated probably a lot of challenge. Yeah. I'm laughing now. I'm sure you weren't laughing at the time, but when you think about kind of that journey, and I know you had a lot of experience kind of even leading up to LimFlow, but for those that are really kind of in the throes, CEOs, founders, and then throes of trying to either map out their approach. Or kind of figure out what is the best path for them when it comes to ClinReg? Are there a couple pieces of advice that you kind of offer up to other folks that are trying to navigate these waters? Hey everyone, let's take a quick break to catch you up on Fastwave Medical, the company I co-founded and lead as CEO. We're developing multiple intravascular lithotripsy systems, or IVL for short, for a market size of over $10 billion. So you may remember the exclusive round of capital I told you we were going to carve out for Fastwave insiders in the cardiovascular space. Well, due to the overwhelming demand, we blew through our cap in just a few weeks and had to close it down much earlier than expected. The incredibly high interest in this exclusive fundraise exceeded even our own expectations. But in retrospect, it sort of makes sense. Here's why. First, Shockwave Medical, which is the only IVL player in town, has a market cap of close to $10 billion. Second, we've designed Fastwave systems to be faster, better, and more efficient, and to disrupt this monopolized category by giving physicians more IVL options to choose from. Third, we've already secured two non-provisional patents from the USPTO, one of which was granted in 6 months, which is almost unheard of in the medtech space. We may open up another private fundraise in the future, so if you're interested in joining our waiting list to invest in one of the hottest cardiovascular therapies, head over to fastwavemedical.com/invest and enter your email. Again, that's fastwavemedical.com/invest. All right, let's get back to the rest of the conversation.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I have any, genius insights other than just had my fingers burned a bunch of times trying to figure this out. And I mean, one thing is that these are just long relationships that you're building with your with the regulatory authority, whether it's in Europe, the U.S., or the PMDA in Japan, or whoever, maybe in China. I mean, when you're discussing your first in man, you have to be discussing what are you committing to? How are you framing things? How are you positioning things vis-a-vis what you're going to talk about when you get to the pivotal, right? And I think, these discussions have long tails, right? And they have very long memories, right? So I think you really have to have very robust strategic discussions and be very thoughtful about how you position things, because you've got a long road ahead of you, right? And, we had a lot of work with LimFlow to, agree what primary endpoints looked like. And we were in a space that nobody had really done a trial in this patient population. We had to educate them on the patient population. We had to develop core lab adjudication for things that had never been core lab adjudicated before in a PMA trial. We had to, there were just tons of things that we were in a working relationship with them. They were learning, we were learning. But at the same time, you're trying to drive towards something that you can accept as a trial, right? Because there are certainly companies that get proposals back of things that they cannot do, right? Yep. And I was talking to somebody a couple months ago, and it's like, yeah, we're going into our final meeting with the FDA, and if they stick with what they've said we need to do, we're shutting down because that's undoable. And I was dove in it. I was like, yeah, it sounds undoable, man. Right? That's not going to happen. And then a great technology just can't be tested, right? And that's not the FDA's fault. That's not the company's fault. But sometimes you arrive at a crossroads, and you got to make sure you handle that discussion properly and over years, right? I think another thing is really being honest with yourself and your team about where your package is, where your testing is, what the risks are, right? What you know, what you don't know. You know, sometimes everybody wants to be optimistic and think that everything's buttoned up and dialed in. But I think engaging in a culture of, hey, this is the reality, right? And these are the real risks is healthy. I'm not sure I got an A grade with that as, as I was learning to do this in my first CEO role. But, you know, I think there is something to benefit of saying like, you know, hey, this is really where we at here. Where's our backup plan? You know, what do we need here and there rather than just hoping everything works, which again, hope is a requirement.
Right.
But it is not the solution.
Oh yeah, no doubt. No doubt. I mean, and that's a real challenge, right? Because I think most of us that are, you know, and those listening are probably bent towards like the entrepreneurial ecosystem, and optimism is a part of that, right? I mean, you have to be optimistic and hopeful to your point, but being intellectually honest about that's always it's a balance. And I think it's a good reminder to not rely on hope, right? If everything is contingent upon, well, we think it's going to go out this way, or we think, right? The important point is like, yeah, that's okay, but you need to maybe look around the corner and have an option B and an option C, right? In the event that, you know, things aren't as hopeful as they seem.
Yeah, I have come to believe that you know, the backup plan is very often the plan. It's just not the plan yet. And so you better have the backup plan. Otherwise, you know, you're going to be in trouble, and you better have accounted that it's going to take a bit. So.
Oh yeah. Yeah. No doubt. I mean, you often find yourselves like parallel pathing, like almost everything, right? It's like, maybe you have your lead path, but you know, your paths B and C are maybe equally as likely to come to fruition. The other thing that you mentioned is, and I think it's just really a helpful framework to almost force yourself to take a step back, because it's so easy, I think, for any founder, CEO, even if you're on a leadership team in a smaller company, you know, you're always typically biased towards like action, right? And momentum and making decisions and kind of moving quickly. But that path, that Reg Klin path, is, as you mentioned, Dan, is so long. And part of that is building relationships. So one example is if you submit, say you do a pre-sub, right? You think the pre-sub is the best path forward, and you want to, there's some key questions you want FDA to ask, and your pre-sub package is not good, and it's missing a lot of parts, and it raises a lot of questions. Well, that's not a good first look, right? With relationships that you're trying to build with regulatory bodies. So I think just being cognizant of that, right? That long road, these are people at the end of the day on the other side of the table, and you know, the relationship matters, right? And how you present things matters in that kind of relationship building effort.
Yeah, for sure. And one of the challenges there is, you know, they're going to bring a squad of people, right? You don't know if those people are new to the FDA or the project, or old hands who kind of see this in perspective, right? And have dealt with, you know, 40 companies, right? So you don't know who's, you know, if you're going to tarnish yourself or not. You know, they're going to talk about what you submit afterwards, and you're setting the stage. And so I think there are ways to say, look, we are early, and we think the important things are here. We plan to, and those things that we think important, we really have done well, right? Mm-hmm. But we recognize all the other stuff might take longer, I think. But they're always challenging because, you know, every time you get into one of these meetings, it's like 60 minutes and you're like staring at your watch the whole time, you know, like how far are we on the agenda? Have we asked the right question? Did someone throw a wrench into kind of the agenda and it's taken us off into a rabbit hole? I mean, you got to really be prepared to pull things back on the road during those meetings. They can be, I mean, I can tell you, we had a bunch of meetings at Linfo over the years, and some of them were not pre-subs, but like real interactions at various levels of the organization. Mm-hmm. And they are about the most stressful thing that goes on. There's like, you know, it's literally 60 minutes or whatever they're giving you, and it will not go over, and you cannot really control what happens, mm-hmm. right? So those are moments that make or break companies. And so having great reg folks, Zachary Woodson led our reg and quality side of things was brilliant. And I think that's and having the right advisors along, having the right doctors with you, vetting what relationship those doctors have with the FDA. Everybody says they've got a great relationship with the FDA. Find out exactly how many times they've been, what projects they represented, right? Who they know. Do your diligence on your doctors before. We had great, that's not like we didn't have an issue there, but it is a very small world, right? And sometimes doctors are showing up with a bunch of different projects and the FDA can kind of, has different views of different docs.
I would say. No doubt. And keeping being very mindful of that, right? Is really, really crucial. Such a good point. Let's talk a little bit about fundraising, right? And we touched on it a bit earlier when we, during the kind of the topic of how do you best work with strategics. But you raised, quite a few rounds of capital, right? For LimFlow. I think you mentioned you're onto your Series D. And so a lot of stages, a ton of discussion with various capital partners, a lot of milestones that, were hit along the way to substantiate, the next raise, et cetera. So when you think about that journey, I'm not sure if you want to focus more on early stage fundraising or kind of, mid to late stage fundraising. Anything that stands out that was especially, insightful, I guess, during that experience, or maybe alternatively, are there things that you see other entrepreneurs, mistakes that you see other entrepreneurs make during fundraising that you hope they, can correct, right, with the, as they go to further down that path?
Yeah, I mean, I was on a call earlier this evening with a few other CEOs. I'm in like a little group. We talk with each other. And one of the things that's really important is just know who you're talking to, right? What kind of investing do they do? What are they looking for? What successes have they had in the past? Do you look like any of those successes? Because that will help you a lot. Are there parallels? Do they really have any money to invest? There's a lot of shopping, and especially these days where it's really hard for VCs to raise money, as hard as it is for startups to raise money, or almost as hard. So I'm not saying don't waste your time, but, get to the point pretty quickly of like, hey, our round, we need to close it by May, Do you have, how many investments out of your current fund are there? How far are you into your current fund? Have you closed your current fund? When they say they're fundraising and they hope to close, I mean, you can keep the door open, but they're not going to solve your problem, right? So, and I find kind of either having those conversations directly or through the grapevine, figuring out who really has money saves a lot of time and energy. You should not be doing diligence with people who can't invest, right? You can be polite, just like they're polite with you, and you can build a relationship. But you need to focus on the people that actually have capital to invest. And so that's oftentimes people are kind of nervous about it, and they don't want to but you can be professional and also just be like, hey, this is what we really need, and this is the look for the people that are Series B investors, Series Z investors, late stage investors are a totally different species. And it's never easy. I do think it's easier the farther you get. I think Series E and D are easier than C and easier than B, and God help you with A. I mean, I've been there, I've done it, but I mean, the hardest ones are the early stage. It's just like there's not much capital around. What is there is less formal, right, in its structure than later stages. So it really is hard, the hardest at the beginning, right? Yeah. That's certainly my, when you get later, it's more, just more structured. There's a lot more money. I mean, just, and one person can solve your round, right? Can write you a $30 million check, or two, you get two people writing $30 million checks and you're there, right? So, that's a lot different than trying to piece together six different investors, each for $1.5 million. And they end up being the same amount of work, right? Each investor. There is hope. It just gets, it's still hard. It just gets slightly easier.
The one, I've fortunate to have a lot of like experienced folks come on this program. And that's the one thing that always stands out to me is like, and even hearing you say it, right? I mean, you've got a ton of you know reps basically, right? Even leading up to LimFlow, and then obviously your experiences through LimFlow and the success story that you and your team were able to kind of achieve. But man, fundraising it's always hard, right? I mean, maybe it gets a little bit easier, right, in those later stages, but it's never like a layup, even for the most experienced folks like yourself that have a lot of great wins under their belt. It's just that idea of trying to convince someone to get on board, right? To paint a picture of something that doesn't exist yet, right? But you really think it can exist, and they need to throw some cap. That's never easy, right? It's never a layup.
Well, and it's interesting because you talk to people who want to be CEOs and they're like, but I don't want to have to raise money. And it's like, well, no one wants to, but it is your number one job. Mm. I mean, I would tell my team, like, I'm doing my job. You guys are getting paid, right? My job is to keep you guys with a job.
So true. So true. So, yeah.
It is a huge, whether it may be 80% of what you're doing, it may be 15% of what you're doing, but it is always there. And it's never a pleasure, mm-hmm. right? But it is the meat of the role, right? Is to keep everybody, keep the project moving forward, keep the team in place, keep the momentum up. Startups are like sharks. They got to keep swimming. They got to mm-hmm. keep moving, right? And if you run out of capital, and have to pause things, I mean, it does more than pause things.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. No doubt. Yeah. The start stopping, that's associated with, pauses, so to speak, man. So those they just crush your timeline. But man, I mean, we were laughing about this, but like you, I'm sure you run into just as many, founders, CEOs that maybe are in the earlier stages, maybe raised a little bit of capital, and they just hate it. Right. They don't want to do it. And I just think that's just a really healthy kind of conversation to have, is that if you're in that boat where you just hate that process, maybe it's not for you. You know what I mean? Because to your point, Dan, like that is the number one thing, right? For a startup CEO is you got to keep money in the bank. You have to.
Being a surgeon and not liking blood.
Yeah.
Not being able to handle, not liking, but handle the sight of blood. I mean, yeah, it's a bloody business.
Yeah.
Right. Fundraising, it's not just the pitching and the repetitiveness of it. And, last year, I started in January, knew I had to raise a Series E, of 60 to 80 million or sell the company. And so I was running a dual process the whole time. I talked to 60, 65 funds, got two term sheets, in the summertime, which is a brilliant, I think, a fantastic result in the middle of the nuclear winter that is fundraising, right? And had an offer to buy the company on mm-hmm. aside that. So, but still, I ground out 60 diligence. I mean, either first conversations or follow-ups and follow-ups and follow-ups. And, that's Excel sheet is a mess. And keeping track of who's seen what and where the conversation was and what you thought it is a huge grind.
Yeah.
And you got to either learn to live with it or not.
Yeah. Right? Oh yeah. No doubt. I'm sure your Excel spreadsheet was slogging, right? It was getting slower and slower as you scroll through the endless rows.
Oh, it starts out, everybody's green. I'm like, oh, look at all this green, like all this opportunity. It's like getting yellow and then reds, as they say, finally know.
I'm sure it's daunting every time you pull it up and you're like, all right, back at it. You know what I mean? But it's part of the game. You have to. No doubt. This is good. I want to leave a few minutes for the rapid fire portion of this discussion, but just real quick. When you decide to tackle a project like this with LimFlow for a huge, huge unmet need, there's always this looming kind of cloud, which is, coverage and reimbursement, right? And so knowing that we have a little bit amount of time, we could probably record a whole conversation around this topic, because it's definitely a huge, huge hurdle to be mindful of, even at the earliest stages, is, generally speaking, kind of what do you think is most important to other entrepreneurs if they're working on something that does not have, existing coverage and reimbursement?
Oh, my God. is to get smart fast, right? I mean, it's the first, well, now when I'm looking, people talking to me about various things, and I'm always like, what's the reimbursement like? And I've become a real, in French, the amateur means amateur, but it means someone who really loves something and is passionate about something, like for wine, for example. It doesn't quite mean like you don't know what you're doing, amateur in English. And I am that in reimbursement, right? Like I have spent a ton of time learning, becoming reasonably fluent with it. And I ended up hiring Jenny Gaffney from Medtronic, who was running reimbursement for their renal denervation and coronary business, to run our, who's just one of the most fantastic people as a person you'll meet, but also as a reimbursement person, amazing, and has generated a gigantic amount of value for us and will for and are going forward. I mean, it's a powerhouse of value creation if you know how to do it, right? And we started with an unclear reimbursement pathway at LymphFlow, right? We said, we had expedited access, which became the breakthrough program. So we were breakthrough before it was breakthrough. And we worked that system, and we worked every angle of clinical trial reimbursement and learning and setting the stage and make sure coding was happening right and becoming experts so that we, when with VCs, we could really speak definitively about how it was going to work, how we were going to be able to price, how this was going to work over time. And you don't have to have all that granularity at the beginning, right? Your level of granularity has to goes up with every round. And I would say in the Series E, at least 35 to 40% of all of our discussions with VCs were about reimbursement. Huge component of what you're doing. Because if they, if doctors, you know, if hospitals can't get paid, doctors can't get paid, nobody's buying. Right. If you can't get past the VAC, it's over from a commercial point of view. So, so I think getting a decent grounding in how the system works, understand the basic vocabulary, have someone, a consultant or someone who, you know, works in the space, maybe in another company, kind of help you get a picture of what the pathway might look like and what the geography is, because it's confusing in the US. Europe is much simpler, in fact. And start from there, and then just know it's going to become like reg or, you know, or quality or something, where you may not have an innate interest in it, right? It's going to become something that you've got to master, right, over time. And not tomorrow, but, you know, I mean, 7 years, I mean, it's like two PhDs worth of work, you know, like you pull some stuff at the end, you know?
No doubt. I remember you mentioned Jenny Gaffney. I remember, I don't know if I ever worked directly with her, but I remember her name being brought up so many times during my Covidian Medtronic days. Cause that one of the startups that we acquired was a company called Saphion, in the venous space. And that did not have, you know, that particular device did not have coverage and reimbursement. So to your point, a topic that I had to sort of kind of get smart on pretty fast, but it's really interesting. I mean, if you're kind of naturally curious about a lot of things, it's a really interesting kind of arena, especially here in the US, right? Cause it is very complicated. And,
absolutely. And if you look at the companies that have been built out of very strong reimbursement strategies, so many of the names that you think of as huge successes came on the back of a really understanding U.S. reimbursement and how their technology could fit into that, and making sure that, you know, they're delivering clinical value, which is what Medicare wants, right? And what every healthcare system wants, but at the same time, the doctors are you know, appropriately compensated, and the hospital systems feel like they're not losing money, and that you can price where you need to price with the expectations of the marketplace, which we all know where they are in terms of gross margin, et cetera. So when you find those spaces, it's awesome, right?
No doubt. Couldn't echo your sentiment enough around it being such a huge issue that you need to address at the various early stages and kind of know what you're getting into. Cause if a doc can't get paid, if a hospital can't get paid, even if it's an awesome technology that solves a real need, it's not ever going to be adopted. If the economics don't make sense. So, really, really good point. We'll link to Dan's LinkedIn profile and the full write-up on MedCiter, so you can learn a little bit about him. And also LimFlow, as I mentioned earlier, LimFlow, LimFlow.com is the website. Of course, it's now under the Inari Medical family, so you can check out Inari's, the rest of Inari's gear as well. So with that said, Dan, I want to be sensitive to your schedule. So I'll run through these rapid fire questions pretty quickly. If you want to expound a little bit, certainly feel free to. I might cut them a little bit short and move from four to three here. But when you think about the last, 7 years building, building LimFlow, what was the most surprising thing that you learned over that time?
Yeah, I mean, I was trying to come up with an answer to this. I think a lot of these things, you think there's some magic process behind the curtain, and when you see behind the curtain for the first time, you're like, oh, this is not that complicated. I mean, it's like, and whether it's doing a deal or raising money or working with the FDA, all these things you can do. When you get there, you'll know what to do, right? You'll have people around you who can help you do it. So don't have there's a mystique about certain things. And in reality, processes are processes. And if you got good people with you, you can solve.
That's good stuff. All right. If you had a room full of med tech entrepreneurs, maybe we were over in Switzerland, enjoying a glass of wine, but you just wrapped up a presentation and wanted to leave them with one key thing that they really need to take home in order to best position their startup for success, what would that be?
I always talk about it. I know it sounds goofy, but I'm like, unless you're clearly benefiting, you can clearly demonstrate or think you will be able to demonstrate clinical benefit for the patient, you've lost the plot, right? Mm-hmm. Cheaper, easier. I'm not interested in that. What I'm interested in is better outcomes for patient. And if you keep the patient in focus, everything else tends to work. The minute the patient isn't in focus, it just becomes like, I don't know, it's not med tech to me. So, mm-hmm. I really think the patient and the patient benefit of what you're developing has to be first in mind all the time.
All right. Last question. If you had a chance to kind of rewind the clock and go and whisper something in the young Dan Rose's ears, maybe in your, mid to late 20s, what would that be from a professional standpoint?
Well, I think even with the acquisition, I think, sometimes people say there is no there, it is it's the satisfaction of working and doing things and accomplishing things. It's not the finish line, or it's not like getting FDA approval that like suddenly transforms your attitude or your outlook, or selling the company that suddenly makes you feel like, you are you. And focusing on like taking pleasure in the satisfaction of the doing, I think is the key, because there's going to be a lot of doing. It is a long road ahead, Dan Rose. There's going to be a lot of doing, and there will be failures. This is my fourth startup. LimFlow is my fourth startup, right? Not my first. So, there will be a lot of pushbacks and a lot of stumbles, right? And a lot of things that don't work out the way you want. But if you can focus on enjoying the doing, right, be a happy journey.
Yeah, that's good way to wrap up the interview. Dan, you didn't have to do this conversation, so I really appreciate that. I mean, you could, you had a lot of startup experience, had a really nice exit. You could, rest off into the sunset, but really, really appreciate you kind of just being willing to offer up so many, like a ton of like, just, really, really insightful stuff, right, to other folks that are in this process, right, of building, of doing. So, I mean, I genuinely mean it. Like, thanks a ton. This is your second time on the program. So really, really appreciate it.
Thank you, Scott, for having me. It was a pleasure.
Yeah, one of the true mentions in our space. So again, for everyone listening, thanks for your attention. As always, we'll link to Dan's LinkedIn profile in the full write up on MedCider that summarizes this conversation and kind of tried to pull out a lot of the key learnings that Dan shared with us. So definitely encourage you to check that out. And Dan, I'll have you hold on the line here. But for everyone, again, thanks as always for joining us along this ride. Hopefully there's a lot of value in this conversation, and hopefully you gleaned as much value as I did. So appreciate it. And until the next episode of MedCider Goes Live, everyone take care. Hey, it's Scott again. One quick thing before you go. You see, I love bringing you insightful conversations with the best founders and CEOs of medical device and health technology startups. But here's the thing, I'd be super grateful if you could help me reach even more ambitious doers who share our passion. So if you found value in this podcast, if you found yourself nodding your head while listening, or if you simply enjoy what we're doing with MedCider, please take a moment to leave us a review. It's super easy. Just open your Apple Podcast app or the podcast app of your choice, search for our show, and scroll down to the ratings and reviews section. Leave your honest thoughts and hit that 5-star rating if you think we're worthy. Your feedback is incredibly important, and it's the best way to ensure we keep bringing you awesome discussions with leading founders and CEOs. So take a moment to be a good friend and leave that review today. As always, thanks for being a part of our journey and for helping MedCider continue to grow and evolve. Your support is greatly appreciated. All right, enough talk about reviews. Stay tuned for another informative episode coming at you soon.